morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. As you can see, one of our panel members is absent today. It's time of year. Michelle Larkin is out with the flu. She will be participating in all respects as far as these case matters that will be heard today are concerned by reviewing and listening to the tape arguments after the hearings today, and then the panel will confer. We stay on the same time frame despite her absence, just so you're aware of that. Both of you are familiar with appellate procedure. Just a reminder, 15 minutes each for presentation of your case in chief, and an additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellate counsel when you're ready. I'll ask our marshal to call the case.
First case this morning is number A190956, Carol Gorman, respondent versus SEIU Healthcare Minnesota et al. Appellants.
Go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Justin Cummins and I represent appellants. Both the federal Garmin preemption doctrine and the federal absolute privilege doctrine each separately require the dismissal of the complaint with prejudice for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The complaint alleges that appellants defamed respondent through speech about the nature and status of grievances filed by appellants under the relevant collective bargaining agreements, or CBAs for short. The appellants filed these grievances on behalf of numerous employees that worked for respondents' employer, worked at the facilities owned and operated by respondents' employer. Regarding the outsourcing of the jobs performed by these employees. In the context of this labor dispute, Your Honors, the appellants allege that the decision to outsource violated the relevant CBAs because of an underlying conflict of interest. Specifically, appellants alleged in the grievances that the decision to outsource was at the recommendation of respondent, and the outsourcing was to a company with which the respondent had a personal connection, specifically a personal relationship with an executive of that company, Morrison. To be clear, the complaint acknowledges that the speech by appellants was fundamentally true. The complaint admits that respondent was the employer executive that led this process of deciding whether to outsource. That's at paragraphs 7 and 8 of the complaint. The complaint also admits that respondent recommended the outsourcing, that she and the team that she led recommended the outsourcing of the hundreds of jobs of defendants' members, the appellant's members, to Morrison. That's also at paragraphs 7 and 8 of the complaint. The complaint further admits that the employer followed respondent's recommendation here and, in fact, outsourced the jobs to Morrison. In addition, Your Honors, as the district court acknowledged in the order regarding the motion to dismiss in this case, the complaint does not dispute that respondent had a personal relationship with a Morrison executive.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
Sure. The district court acknowledged in the order at addendum page 35 that the complaint does not dispute that the respondent had a personal relationship with an executive of Morrison, which is the company to which these hundreds of jobs were outsourced. In other words, Your Honors, the dispute here is only whether these facts give rise to or constitute a conflict of interest within the meaning of the relevant CBAs. That is a labor dispute for an arbitrator to decide, not a defamation claim to litigate in court. That the appellants explicitly qualified their speech underscores the baseless nature of the defamation claim. And for example, as set forth at paragraph 20 of the complaint, the appellants contend that, quote, there may have been a conflict of interest, unquote. I'll now turn to the two legal doctrines that are the basis for the appeal here. The first is federal Garmin preemption. Because the defendant's speech, the appellant's speech arises in a labor dispute, there is a heightened pleading standard imposed. And what that means is that the respondent must plead both actual malice and actual harm. What does actual malice mean? Actual malice means statements that are knowingly false or with reckless disregard for the truth. And the U.S. Supreme Court defines reckless disregard for the truth as, quote, a high degree of awareness of probable falsity. That's the Gertz decision. The Penn site is 418 U.S. at 331.
The district court here did decide that one of the statements, at least one of the defamatory statements, didn't meet that level.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court said that the statements made in the grievances were not actionable. The district court, though, believed that the statements that were made to the public through a public statement by the appellants was actionable. And I'll address that further in a minute. Actual harm means that pleading defamation per se, for example, or even making legally conclusory allegations about harm is not enough. We provided in our briefing a number of cases, U.S. Supreme Court, Eighth Circuit, and other appellate precedent that address specifically this kind of a situation, a defamation claim arising in the context of a labor dispute. Respondent does not address those cases. Those cases clearly show that there is not actual malice here or actual harm pled by the complaint. The cases I'm referring to are the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Austin, where the plaintiffs alleged the union and union leaders alleged that the plaintiff was unethical. In the Beverly Hills Foodland case, Eighth Circuit, the plaintiff was alleged to be racist. In the intercity maintenance case, the plaintiff was alleged to be a plantation-minded manager. In the Beverly Enterprise case, the plaintiffs were alleged to be criminals and Nazi sympathizers. None of these cases supported a defamation claim. There was not, in these cases, there was not enough to state a valid defamation claim. Again, because of the heightened standard that applies to defamation claims that arise in the context of a labor dispute.
What about the Lynn decision? Doesn't that change that argument to some degree? It seems to me that holding that indicated that the proof of such harm, which may include general injury to reputation, consequent mental suffering, et cetera, and other damages generally recovered under state tort law, is sufficient under a Rule 12 level of pleading.
Yes, Your Honor, that potentially is true, but the Beverly Enterprise case, which was subsequent to that, and the Penn site for Beverly Enterprise is 182 F3rd at 188, specifically was analyzing the defamation claim in light of Lynn. And in that case, they concluded that calling the plaintiff criminals and Nazi sympathizers did not cause actual harm. So, but we don't even need to get to the actual harm piece. There is no pleading of actual malice here. What we have here is a dispute about whether the conflict of interest that is alleged by the appellants rises to the level of a contract violation, a violation of the CBAs. Again, that is something for an arbitrator to decide.
What about the dubious ethics remark?
Correct.
Doesn't that...
That gets to the conflict of interest, Your Honor, and the question of whether the grievances are meritorious. And respondent argues the employer investigated the grievances filed by the appellants, and in the employer's opinion, those grievances don't have merit. But again, that is not evidence of defamation. That's evidence of an ongoing labor dispute. Literally every day, arbitrators in Minnesota or across the country are deciding labor disputes like this. This is not defamation. It is a labor dispute.
Are you acknowledging that the statements that are pled here as defamatory are statements of fact? Do you agree that they're statements of fact, or are they statements of opinion that don't constitute defamation to begin with?
Well, some of them are statements of opinion. Ultimately, the appellants were intending to prove the merits of the allegations for purposes of the grievances. The grievances were ultimately settled, along with unfair labor practice charges that the appellants filed in connection with entering into a successor collective bargaining agreement with respondent's employer. But the appellants in good faith believe that there were contract violations here, and that's what they stated in their grievances, and that's what they stated in their communications about the grievances. The respondent also relies heavily on decisions that do address defamation claims, but it's really important to be clear. None of these decisions address defamation claims in the context of a labor dispute. When you have defamation claims coming up in a labor dispute, the analysis is different, as the Austin case says, as the Lynn case says, because it's understood that in the context of labor disputes, it's heated. There's hyperbole. There's frankly inflammatory rhetoric and so forth. So the courts give a lot of latitude in this context. So the cases that respondent relies on have no application here. The respondent also says, and I addressed this briefly already, but they say evidence of malice here is that the employer investigated these grievances allegedly and believes that the grievances don't have merit. That is not evidence of malice. That's evidence.
Also, at their request, did not produce any evidence to support that.
That's correct. And Your Honor, the appellants are not under any obligation to provide that. They don't have to prove their case before they present their case in the arbitration. What at the very most, what the appellants would have to produce are documents before the hearing. If the National Labor Relations Board issued an order to that effect, or an arbitrator issued a subpoena to that effect. The employer here chose to seek neither. For these reasons, the garment preemption doctrine precludes the claims. They divest the court of subject matter jurisdiction related to the defamation claims. Unless Your Honors have other questions, I'll move on to the absolute privilege.
Go ahead.
Okay. The federal absolute privilege, even putting aside the garment preemption doctrine, bars the defamation claim here. The federal absolute privilege doctrine protects any statements that are made in connection with the grievance process. In other words, even statements that involve actual malice and cause actual harm are not actionable if the speech is made in connection with the grievance process.
So how is a press release a statement made in connection with a grievance process?
Correct. So, and to be clear here, the courts have not limited the privilege to statements made in a grievance hearing. The grievance process, and as the Svensson case says, this privilege is extremely broad. So the statements that were made in the press release, they were made to the public, they were about the grievance, the nature of the grievance, the status of the grievance. This is precisely what the U.S. Supreme Court said is protected by the First Amendment. And the case in particular I'm referring to is the Thomas v. Collins case. We quote it on page 15 of our opening brief. And I'll quote, this case says it pretty emphatically. This is a direct quote. The dissemination of information concerning the facts of a labor dispute must be regarded as within that area of free discussion that is guaranteed by the Constitution. It is routine for unions and for union members to communicate to the public about their labor disputes. For that reason, we have handbilling on a regular basis. We have bannering. We have picketing. There's another case that we cite which addresses handbilling specifically. This is the DiPartolo case. The pin site for that is 485 U.S. at 575-76. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court says, quote, the handbills involved here truthfully revealed the existence of a labor dispute, and goes on to say, on his face, this was expressive activity.
In the context of a labor dispute, is there any confidentiality attached to the actual grievance that's prepared itself, or is either party free to release the actual grievance to the public?
There typically is not confidentiality. Certainly.
But if you have a situation where an employee is discharged, I mean, you reveal as much as necessary. You don't go beyond that.
That's correct.
Why would this be any different?
Because this wasn't a discharge grievance. This was a contract interpretation grievance. It affects the entire bargaining unit. It's not about a particular employee. It's about entire units of employees, hundreds of employees. And there's a larger context here, Your Honor. The time that this outsourcing was happening, at this very time, the employer was receiving substantial public monies, tax dollars, in relation to the Destination Medical Center. And so you have local residents who have worked for this facility, at this facility, or these facilities for decades, and all of a sudden their jobs are being outsourced. So it was a matter of public concern, it was a matter of public import. The respondent, so the complaint acknowledges that the statements here are made in connection with the grievance process. So the respondent shifts to, in effect, change the subject or try to. They first say that the cases I just quoted to you, the Thomas v. Collins case and the DiBartolo case, were not free speech cases. And that is simply incorrect. As I just quoted to you, the DiBartolo case, which dealt with the issue of handbilling, and the Thomas case dealt with free speech rights as well. And the pin site for that is 323 U.S. at 540. I see my time is up.
That's pretty quickly. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Cummins.
Good morning, Your Honors. Pat Turney, I appear for the respondent. Carol Gorman. There are two legal issues on this appeal, the preemption issue and the absolute privilege issue, and now there appears to be a factual issue, too. The statements that we don't take issue with some of the defamatory statements is wrong. Our complaint alleges the statements that we contend to be false and defamatory. The trial judge did not say that we don't take issue with those. At page 35 of the brief, of the addendum to their brief, page 18 of the trial court's decision, what she said is we don't take issue with those statements to the extent that they were made in the grievance hearing, because that would be absolutely privileged. The next paragraph begins with rather and goes on to say we do take issue with those statements to the extent that they're published in press releases and on the website. So that's just a misinterpretation, a misstatement of what the trial judge did in this case. We do take issue. We take issue with the claim that there was a long-standing personal relationship between Carol Gorman and a Morrison executive. That's a false statement. That's what our complaint alleges.
Did you need to deny that?
I mean,
you haven't denied that there was a relationship.
In our complaint, we allege that the statement that there's a long-standing personal relationship between Carol Gorman and a Morrison executive is a false statement. Paragraph 15 and 22 of our complaint. That's a false statement. That's what Rochester Mayo Clinic investigated and found that their claim, the union's claim, to be not true.
Why is the investigation of the employer even relevant to our consideration? Why do they have to rely on Carol Gorman's employer to say, oh, there's nothing to that? It seems to me that would be part of the litigation.
And I would generally agree with you. In the context of a defamation case, a state court defamation case, which I believe we're in here and I'll talk about preemption next, in the context of that state, that facts, if they're put on notice that what they, in a defamation case, if they're put on notice that what they've said is false, okay, that goes to the issue of constitutional malice. The Hart-Hanks v. Connaughton case, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, says you can't purposefully avoid discovering the truth. If you do, that's malice, okay? So if they're told that what they said is false, they ignore that, they're asked to provide additional information, they're told it's investigated, they're asked to provide additional information, they don't, in the context of a defamation case, they're put on notice that they've published a false statement. So if republish it, it's publication with knowledge or with a reckless disregard.
So what's the actionable false statement? That there was a long-term personal relationship or that there was a conflict of interest because of that?
Both. In combination, we deny that there's a long-term personal relationship. If there's no long-term personal relationship, there's no conflict of interest. So they kind of go hand in hand. There's no ethical issue if there's no personal long-term relationship. We also take issue with the statement that if there were such a relationship, that it is what influenced the decision of Mayo. It is not. We believe Mayo will testify that, yes, they took that into consideration, the recommendation, but they reviewed the underlying information and made their own independent decision. So we think there's a number of false and defamatory statements, the ones we articulate in the complaint, that are all actionable statements of fact. And to your question, yes, these are statements of fact. The cases they talk about are hyperbole. That's why those statements, the Austin case, the list of cases where they talk about inflammatory language being used in the union setting, it is true. In any defamation case, you must have an actionable statement of fact. And that, I think, is what led to Your Honor's question, an actionable statement of fact. In the cases they cite, they're talking about statements that were considered to be hyperbole, statements that are exaggerated language that are not meant to be taken seriously. That's hyperbole, and that's why those cases are distinguishable. In this case, we have specific factual statements, statements that under Milkovich can be proved to be true or false, Milkovich being the U.S. Supreme Court decision that says a statement is actionable. Opinion doesn't matter. A statement is actionable if it can be proved to be true or false.
So, of course, the posture of this case is we're reviewing the denial of appellant's Rule 12 motion.
Correct.
So there's been very little discovery up to this point.
None.
Yeah, if the case continues beyond this appeal, it would seem to me there'd be substantial discovery on the nature of the relationship between Ms. Gorman and anybody with this competitor.
Sure.
So what does that do to your claim then? Suppose the discovery shows that Ms. Gorman did have a personal relationship with an executive of the competitor that gets the contract. Does that change? And then does that move your claim to the union statements that it's belief that there's a conflict of interest because of that?
It would. I mean, it would. And discovery, you're right. At this stage, all this court has is what's in the complaint, but we deny that there's that relationship. If discovery shows that there's a long-term personal relationship, the next step would be, did that influence the decision? Was that the primary factor influencing the decision? It certainly becomes a weaker case. I don't think it's dispositive at that point, but that would be a significant factor, yes, and there's been no discovery. It's our position, if getting back to where I meant to start, the preemption issue, the Lynn case that Your Honor referenced does say that if we've alleged constitutional malice and an actual injury, that we should survive this Rule 12 motion. The cases don't say there's a heightened burden of pleading. The cases say there's a heightened burden of proof. We are still under Rule 8, notice pleadings. We allege in the complaint constitutional malice, and we do allege specific facts of constitutional malice, that they're told they're publishing something false, they're told it's been investigated, that it's false, and they republish. That is, under Hart-Hanks, the definition of constitutional malice. So we have pled constitutional malice, and we have pled an actual injury. Under both Lynn and under Gertz, actual injury simply means you can't presume damages. It is the law in Minnesota in any case where you have to prove constitutional malice, you have to prove an actual injury as well. You cannot have presumed damage in any case in this jurisdiction where constitutional malice must be proved. It doesn't change the law in this state. All that means is that we have to allege that there's been harm to reputation, emotional injury, emotional distress, and that is in the complaint. And that's what Gertz and that's what Lynn says we must allege and prove, and Lynn actually refers us back to state law on that issue. So we've alleged both of those, and I think the more significant thing, and I don't think this is a preemption issue, is we have to allege an actionable statement of fact. And that's where the Austin case and the cases that they rely on are distinguished. They don't allege in those cases actionable statements of fact. They're basing their claim on hyperbole, exaggerated language that is not meant to be taken seriously, the definition of hyperbole under our case law. So the second argument we make on preemption is this, that the case law, the Alice Chalmers case and others, make it Alice Chalmers being a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Luke that in order for there to be preemption, the resolution of the claim must substantially depend upon interpretation of the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. This case doesn't depend on those terms.
But this is a defamation case, not a breach of contract.
It's a defamation case, but it talks about tort claims in there as well, as do the other cases we cite. You're correct, that was a contract case, but it does talk about other tort cases. In this context, there is nothing in the collective bargaining agreement that needs to be interpreted. Whether there's an agreement or not, what Carol Gorman has been accused of is having a long-term personal relationship that impacted a decision that cost maybe 700 people in the Rochester area their jobs, regardless of what the collective bargaining agreement says, regardless of any provision in the agreement. That's a defamatory statement standing in and of itself, and is factually independent of anything that's in the collective bargaining agreement. There's not one provision in that agreement that needs to be interpreted to resolve this defamation claim. And based on that line of cases that we talk about in the brief, preemption just does not apply at all. This is nothing, this is just a state court defamation claim. Preemption does not apply unless there's some argument that the collective bargaining agreement itself needs to be interpreted, and there isn't. Their second argument is on absolute privilege. They're claiming that the union would have an absolute right to publish knowingly false statements on websites or on social media or wherever, and that is not the law. What Svensson says and what the case they primarily rely on here is that a letter between the employer and the union falls within the grievance process, so that letter is a privileged communication. But there is no case that says that statements made outside, the case law is just the opposite, cases made outside of the grievance process are not protected by the absolute privilege. Our claim here and what the district court recognizes, we're not making claims based on what was said within the grievance hearing. Our claims are based exclusively on what was said in press releases and on their media, on their Facebook or site, their social media site. Our claim is limited to those statements, not to what is said within the grievance process itself. There is no case anywhere that protects those under an absolute privilege argument. So, Your Honors, for these reasons, preemption in this case does not apply because we have alleged in the complaint both constitutional malice and actual injury and a statement of fact upon which a defamation claim can be based. And preemption does not apply because there is nothing in the collective bargaining agreement that needs to be interpreted or addressed in order to resolve this defamation claim. So preemption does not apply. Absolute privilege does not apply because we are not talking about statements within the quasi-judicial administrative proceeding. We're not talking about those. We are talking about statements, only statements, that are published outside of that on press releases and on the web page. So unless there are questions, Your Honor, just ask this court to affirm the trial judge and send this back to the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Tierney.
Your Honors, I'll start with Section 301 preemption, the absolute privilege issue first. The respondent relies on cases that are demonstrably inapplicable. The cases that they cite in their brief, and they've alluded to here today, deal with situations where statements were made prior to a grievance even being filed. That obviously is different than here. And self-evidently cannot be a situation where the statements are being made in connection with the grievance process because no grievance process has commenced. In addition, the cases that they cite are district court or court of appeals decisions and are superseded by the U.S. Supreme Court cases that we cited and we quoted and I've discussed a little bit here this morning. These are cases that respondent didn't even really address in their briefing because they really don't have an answer, and that's the DiBartolo case and the Collins case. I want to, unless you have questions, move back to preemption briefly. Council has referred to the Alice case, which is a Section 301 preemption case. That has nothing to do with this. We are asserting Garmin preemption. Section 301 preemption, Council's correct, deals with a situation where interpreting a CBA is the basis for deciding the issue. That is not the basis for Garmin preemption. Garmin preemption is where the issue at hand implicates the NLRA. Either the conduct at issue arguably is prohibited or protected by the National Labor Relations Act. Garmin preemption is completely different, so the Alice case has nothing to do with this. The respondent has also relied at the hearing today and in their briefing, again, on cases that are completely irrelevant. They have nothing to do with defamation claims coming out of a labor dispute. And that's really the critical point here, Your Honors, is that the statements made were in the context of a labor dispute. And what respondent wants to do is invite the court in to, and courts are reluctant to do this because they don't want to be used tactically for purposes of getting an unfair advantage in the grievance process. And so courts are reluctant to wade into labor disputes like we have here. So, and I believe it's the Lynn decision, either Lynn or Austin does say, in fact, that there is a heightened pleading and proof standard. It's not just proof, pleading. Why? Because again, the public policy and the longstanding recognition is that courts should not be wading into labor disputes because of the nature of these disputes. So what does that mean here? It means that they must allege facts to show that there was a statement that was knowingly false or likely knowingly false, essentially reckless disregard for the truth. And Your Honors, the complaint does not allege that, nor does it allege actual harm.
Well, don't they allege that after your client was advised that the employer investigated the claims, they found there was no basis for them, and then the statements were republished? That's what Mr. Tierney just argued as being evidence of actual malice.
Correct, Your Honor. And what that is evidence of is a labor dispute, not actual malice. Again, the question of whether there was a violation of the CBAs here is for an arbitrator to decide. It's not a defamation claim. If that's the case, then frankly, there are hundreds of defamation claims right now around the country. And there aren't. These are labor disputes to be decided by an arbitrator. Unless Your Honors have additional questions, I will conclude by respectfully requesting that the appeal be accepted, that the complaint be dismissed with prejudice for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today and arguing in support of your client's case. The arguments are under advisement. The briefs were well done, and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe.